Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hello, folks. Dominic here. Before we begin, a quick heads up. The first half of this episode is kind of a reset. The topic I am about to discuss, Tutankhamun's successor in the political situation when he died, is complicated, and scholars have their own interpretations of the evidence. Also, some historians are currently revisiting some of the material, and it's quite likely that Egyptologists will have new perspectives over the next couple of years. That makes it tricky for me. My discussion and conclusions are based on current thinking, but I will probably need to revisit this episode sooner rather than later. To keep things flexible, I'm going to separate this episode into two parts. First, we cover what has happened recently and what we know about the major players and how all of it fits together. Then, in chapter two, we will resume our narrative. If you don't need a refresher, if you are on top of the main story, feel free to skip the first half. There is a time code in the description if you want to do that. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy the show. Salam alaikum, peace be upon you. Welcome back to the History of Egypt podcast, episode 155, The Queen's Gambit. Today, we cover a shadowy, vague situation. The death of King Tutankhamun left a vacuum in the royal family. Now, the Egyptian government had to adjust to new circumstances and plot a path forward. What would they, and specifically Queen Ankhesenamun, do? This episode comes to you on behalf of Mycost, who joined the Patreon as a priest for an entire year. Incredible. Mycost, you are too generous. I am in your debt. To maintain balance, the temples will sing to Neith and Aset, or Isis, on your behalf. May these great deities come to be your protection. May they fan air to your nostrils, clear your windpipe that you may breathe, and cause your enemies to fall beneath your sandals. To everyone listening, thank you for joining me. On with the story. The year was 1334 BCE. Approximately, give or take, roughly, you get the point. We are in a confusing situation. Depending how you read the evidence, it is possible that Egypt was temporarily without a pharaoh. Following the death of King Tutankhamun, Neb-Khepru-Ra, the royal line had officially come to its end. The king had no son, or brothers, or nephews, no one to carry the line. As a result, his widow, Queen Ankhesenamun, was, for a moment, the sole ruler of Egypt. We do not know how long this lasted, and if you ask certain historians, they might place these events even earlier in the 18th dynasty. I covered all of that last episode, but suffice to say, I'm going on one particular interpretation of the evidence, but all of this could change with new material. With that in mind, what do we know about the Egyptian royal household? Specifically, what were their priorities, what were their concerns, and who were the major players in this situation? We'll start with Ankhes and Amun, the Queen of Egypt, or Ta-Khemet-Nesut, the king's great wife. At this point, Queen Ankhes and Amun was 25 years old, give or take. She had entered this world during the reign of King Akhenaten and Queen Nefertiti. She had grown up under those rulers, and then she had become Queen of Egypt herself when Tutankhamun, her brother or cousin or half-brother, ascended to the throne. So Ankhes and Amun had spent her entire life in the royal court. She was immersed in that society, and her priorities may have reflected that background. Last time, we saw how Ankhes and Amun may have sent a letter to the king of Hatti, the great ruler of the Hittite kingdom. Apparently, Ankhes and Amun had asked for a son, a prince, to be her new husband, to be the new king of Egypt. Again, there is some debate about when exactly this event took place, but I am going with the Ankhes and Amun and Tutankhamun interpretation. With that in mind, if Ankhes and Amun was this queen who sent a letter to the Hittites, what was she trying to achieve? It is difficult to parse the motives of people dead for 3,000 years, but at the very least, we can probably guess that Ankhes and Amun wanted to maintain some control over the royal household. Either she wanted to carry on as a ruling lady, or she wanted to maintain stability and political continuity. The fact that she and Tutankhamun had no surviving children may have been a significant concern. If she had married that Hittite prince, perhaps Ankhes and Amun could have started a new line. It would have been a mixed line with some foreign heritage, but at the very least, it would have continuity with earlier generations. Unfortunately, that was not going to happen. The Hittite prince was dead, and as a result, Egypt was in open conflict with the Hittites. So, as the sole ruler of Egypt, quote-unquote, Ankhes and Amun was in a sensitive position. We don't know how much support, if any, she had for her letter to the Hittite prince. Presumably there were some people in the court who were willing to take that chance, because King Suppiluliuma had investigated the queen's letter. He had sent diplomats to Egypt to find out what was happening. If Ankhes and Amun was going rogue, acting alone, chances are Suppiluliuma would have learned of that, but he felt confident enough to actually send a son. That suggests, at least vaguely, that some people in the Egyptian court were open to that path. Had Ankhes and Amun formed a faction of loyalists or servants who were willing to follow her? Maybe. We don't have any direct evidence for that, but it's hard to imagine a ruler, even a wife of a pharaoh, being able to go against her entire government. Chances are there were some people on board with her. Nevertheless, the queen's letters to the king of Hatti indicated that she was afraid. She emphasized the fact that she and her late husband had no son, and she made a point of saying that she did not want to marry a servant, quote-unquote. In other words, it seems like there may have been some dispute, debate, or conflict within the Egyptian court. At the very least, somebody may have been pressuring Ankhes and Amun to make a marriage alliance with an Egyptian family, to choose a noble or a courtier, and raise him to the status of pharaoh. For some reason, Ankhes and Amun did not want to do that. We can speculate on her motivations. Maybe she thought a foreigner would be easier to control. Maybe she wanted somebody of royal blood, even if it was foreign blood. It is possible that Ankhes and Amun was a kind of snob, that she viewed people outside of royal bloodlines as not worthy of the inheritance. Again, that is pure speculation. We do not know anything about this woman as a personality, but it is possible that she valued royalty and bloodline above other things. We can't rule that out. Whatever her motivations, Ankhes and Amun's gambit had failed. The prince of Hatti, Zananza, had died, either en route to Egypt or after arriving in the country. Now, the Hittites were attacking Egyptian territories in Syria and Canaan, so there was a broad open conflict going on. At the same time, the royal family had come to its end. Ankis and Amun's choices were going to shape the next generation. And amidst all of that, Egypt's government was still undergoing a major phase of restoration and reformation. King Tutankhamun and his administration had spent 10 years building new temples, restoring old sanctuaries, and generally investing in Egypt's religious infrastructure. They had done a lot of work, but chances are it was still unfinished. So the Egyptian government had multiple projects on the go. Somebody needed to be in control. With that in mind, Ankis and Amun's failure to make a Hittite prince the king must have been a major crisis. Politically, even personally, this was a tipping point. Moving forward, she would have to choose an Egyptian. She would have to make a servant, quote-unquote, the new pharaoh. But who would she choose? Who were the best candidates? The government of King Tutankhamun and Ankis and Amun is notable for its prominent, powerful courtiers. There were several men in high levels of administration who wielded incredible power and influence in the country. We don't know if these people were unusually powerful under Tutankhamun, or if they are just unusually visible. We can debate that in academic circles. But the point is, Ankis and Amun had multiple servants to choose from. All of them had their own power, their own influence. But of course, two of them are particularly important. The two most prominent men in Tutankhamun and Ankis and Amun's government were the high courtiers Ay and Horemheb. Both of these men were wealthy, influential, powerful, and connected to various sectors of Egyptian society. Arguably, both of these men would be a good candidate for the kingship. So, if Ay and Horemheb were the two main choices, how would Ankis and Amun choose? Let's start with Ay. Ay was a high-ranking member of the royal court. He had been a prominent individual for decades. Ay served King Tutankhamun, but he also served Akhenaten, Tutankhamun's main predecessor. In other words, the courtier had been powerful for more than 20 years. In that time, he must have built up many connections with powerful and wealthy families, and chances are he had a strong contingent of supporters. Surprisingly, we don't know that much about Ay during the reign of Tutankhamun. Some of the best evidence for this individual actually comes from the reign of Akhenaten rather than the boy king. Ay had a tomb at Amarna, Akhenaten's capital city. That tomb was magnificent, easily the largest and most impressive of the non-royal tombs in the city. In other words, Ay was a close and respected confidant of King Akhenaten, and he seems to have continued that role in the reign of Tutankhamun. So Ay had been influential for decades. That was an asset in terms of experience and political connections and support, but it was probably a liability as well. By the time Tutankhamun died, Ay would have been in his 50s, possibly older. By ancient standards, he had lived a long life already. He had overcome or escaped major illnesses and injury, and his diet and lifestyle must have been good enough to reach a fine old age. Hypothetically, Ay should have been in his sunset years, but in this moment of political crisis, he was at the center of events. Now overall, Ay seems to be a sort of advisor or courtier for the king. He is not much of an administrator or bureaucrat. We get this from his titles and the references to this individual. He seems to emphasize jobs that bring him close to the king, that give him confidence and communication with the ruler. To date, all of the evidence we have points to Ay as a sort of advisor. And you will find this characterization in the major studies that are currently popular. Aidan Dodson, Mark Gabold, and Nozomu Kawai all follow the same general trend. They present Ai as a kind of mentor or counselor for the king. So at best, we can say that Ai was close to the throne, and he was probably influential in a personal or political capacity. Did he have much administrative power? Was he in control of any government departments or groups? That is a bit more vague. Ai had a couple of titles, like overseer of the king's horses or chariots. He was also a true scribe, whom the king loves, and fanbearer at the right of the king. So he had some prominent titles, but nothing particularly important when it came to the government. Ai's primary title, the one he used more than any other, was Yit Necher, or God's Father. This title is vague. It can mean different things in different contexts. But the way Ai uses it seems to imply a sort of tutor or advisor or counselor relationship with the king. He emphasizes his good communication, the way the kings trusted him, and how he spoke to them, learned from them, and gave them good advice. In other words, bringing it all together, Ai comes across as a man who doesn't have control over the government, but has a lot of friends and a lot of influence with the right people. In the world of politics, of relationships between individuals and groups, those connections and that influence can be a powerful tool. So, as a candidate for the kingship, Ai would have several points in his favour. Firstly, he had served a long time. He had experience and connections and backing. That could also be a problem. He was quite old, and if he did inherit, he probably would not rule that long. Nevertheless, Ai's longevity was a point in his favour. He was intimately familiar with royal society and courtly politics. It is possible that Ai had a connection of some sort to the royal family. Many scholars have wondered if this courtier could be the father of Queen Nefertiti. Nefertiti turned up mostly from nowhere, and people have looked for her parents ever since. One of the most popular candidates for that parent is Ai. Unfortunately, there is no direct evidence for this. None of Ai's titles or background ever refer to him as Father of the Queen, or anything remotely like that. The title of God's Father might capture a sense of father-in-law, possibly, maybe. We really don't know, and in my opinion, historians are really speculating on that interpretation. The point is, Ai might have been related by marriage to the royal family. If that is true, it would give him some legitimacy as an heir to the throne. But again, I have to stress that that relationship is 100% speculative. We can't really use it as evidence for his value. Finally, Ai may have been a good candidate because he probably had a son. It seems quite likely that Ai had a son, or at least a nephew, a young man named Nakht Min. Again, that relationship is uncertain, but if Nakht Min was the son of Ai, that would probably be a point in Ai's favour. At the very least, the presence of a son, an heir, could guarantee stability for another generation. If Ai took the throne, the royal household might be secure for a few more decades. That could have been a point in his favour. Overall, we really don't know that much about Ai. He seems to have dealt in social and political influence, and those don't always leave evidence in monuments and texts. Nonetheless, it seems fairly clear that Ai was powerful and influential. He must have been a strong contender to be the next king. What about the other candidate? The general Horemheb was one of Tutankhamun's most prominent officials. And unlike Ai, Horemheb had a lot of political control. Horemheb was a high-ranking administrator, a government officer, and a military commander. He has dozens of titles with remarkable jobs in every corner of the government. Some of his most prominent jobs include the titles Hereditary Prince of Southern and Northern Egypt, Deputy of His Majesty in Every Place or the Entire Land, the Foremost of the King's Courtiers, the Fanbearer on the Right of the King, and so forth. Horemheb had dozens of jobs. There were army titles, bureaucracy titles, religious titles, social titles, all the honours you could shake a stick at. So unlike I, Horemheb was deeply involved in Egypt's government, or at the very least, involved in a way that left evidence for us to see. We know a lot about Horemheb thanks to his tomb. During the reign of Tutankhamun, Horemheb started construction on a tomb, a magnificent monument at Saqqara. In the late 18th dynasty, the necropolis of Saqqara was home to ancient and wonderful buildings. Saqqara is the home of the step pyramid of Netjeriket Djoser, aka Egypt's first pyramid. Well, Horemheb built his tomb almost in the shadow of that ancient pyramid. Around this time, royal officials started building large tombs at Saqqara, and this cemetery would become a splendid necropolis. We'll revisit the site multiple times over the coming years. But long story short, the tomb of Horemheb is a wonderful resource for this man, his life, and his career in Egypt's royal government. Now, depending on the scholar, you can get a slightly different picture of Horemheb in different circumstances. Nozomu Kawai views Horemheb as the highest power in the land. The general had so many titles and fingers in every pie that he seems to have been a major influence in Egypt's government. For Kawai, Horemheb may have been the, quote, real governor of the country under King Tutankhamun. From some perspectives, he could have been the regent of that king. With that in mind, Horemheb surely was a good candidate to be the new ruler. Other scholars follow similar thinking. Aidan Dodson also describes Horemheb as Tutankhamun's regent, quote-unquote, and Mark Gabold describes Horemheb as having power almost equal to the king himself. Of course, we always have to be careful with people like this. Men like Horemheb, I, and any official had good reason to emphasize or exaggerate their power and splendor. This was useful. It enhanced their political and personal glory. Nevertheless, it seems Horemheb was a truly powerful man. As far as government and administrative authority goes, he seems to be the most influential person in Tutankhamun's government. Whether he was as powerful or even more powerful than the king? That's a matter of interpretation, how you view the ancient Egyptian state. The fact is, Horemheb, as far as we can tell, was an incredibly powerful man. So, right out the gate, Horemheb had some good credentials to be the new king. He had political and administrative authority. He was involved in many aspects of government. And chances are he had connections, relationships, and influence with a great many people, groups, and families. With that in mind, Horemheb must have had a strong claim to the throne. If Ankhesen Amun was looking for a powerful servant, he would be a good candidate. We don't know much about Horemheb's family. We know that he had a wife named Amenia, but as far as we can tell, he did not have any children. Certainly, he did not have a son. That may have been a problem for his claim. If Horemheb wanted to be the next king, he didn't have an heir. There was no one to take up the throne following him. That probably weakened his candidacy, because choosing Horemheb would be a temporary measure. It's possible the situation would repeat itself within a few years. Again, all of that is speculative. Maybe Horemheb did have children who we just don't know about. We can't be sure. The point is, as far as we can tell, Horemheb had a wife but no children. That could have been a problem, socially. So overall, Horemheb was a really strong candidate for kingship. He had political authority, bureaucratic control, and military power. All the things that you would need from a pharaoh. When Ankhes and Amun, or the court, was debating these choices, Horemheb must have been a strong candidate. So, who would Ankhes and Amun choose? It was almost a 50-50 choice. The high courtiers Ai and Horemheb were both viable candidates in their own way. The queen's choice must have been tricky. Who did Ankhes and Amun go with? The answer will come after the break. See you in a moment.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And now we present the award for next pharaoh. The nominees are Ai, the god's father, the overseer of the chariots of his majesty. Horemheb, deputy of the king and hereditary noble of southern and northern Egypt. And the kingship goes to Ai, the god's father, the overseer of the chariots of his majesty.
This is Ai's first win for the next pharaoh award and his first nomination.
In his 50s or 60s, the elderly courtier Ai ascended the throne. Surprisingly, the record for this event is tiny. A single artifact from the period might give a clue to the mechanism of Ai's ascent. It is a curious piece. If you go to Berlin, Germany, and visit the New Museum, you will find a ring. It is small, made of faience, and it has the shape of cartouches. The containers that go around royal names. There are two of these cartouches, side by side. On the right, we have the cartouche Keper Keperu Ra. This is the name of Ai as the pharaoh. On the left, we have a different name, Ankh Esen Amun. This is the widow of Tutankhamun, the king's great wife, the queen of Egypt. What's happening here? This tiny ring is probably our best evidence for how the courtier Ai claimed power. There are at least two ways to interpret it. The classic view is that the ring marks a marriage between Ai and the queen. Perhaps Ankhes and Amun finally conceded and took a servant as her husband. If so, that might be how Ai came to be the pharaoh. However, there are caveats. We actually don't have any evidence for Ai and Ankhes and Amun acting as a husband and wife. In all of these surviving records, the texts, the art, and the statues, King Ai never references Ankhes and Amun as the king's great wife, the Tahemet Nesut. In fact, apart from this ring, Ai never references Ankhes and Amun at all. So if they did marry, it can't have lasted long. Or it was not a marriage in a modern sense. The second interpretation is an alliance. Perhaps Ankhes and Amun accepted Ai as her partner, quote-unquote. The two could have coexisted with Ai as the king, and Ankhes and Amun in the same position as before. This may sound similar to a marriage, but the distinction would be in the relationship. Instead of a formal family tie, the two may have been political allies. Again, the ring doesn't prove this one way or the other. It just gives the names, and we can speculate on that a lot. The point is, Ai and Ankhes and Amun teamed up in some form. So a single item, a ring, gives a hint at the political resolution. Queen Ankhes and Amun allied herself with the god's father, Ai. Whether this was a marriage or some other arrangement, we don't know. The point is, the queen made her choice, and a servant became the king. We will talk about the new pharaoh next episode. For now, let's keep our eye on Ankhes and Amun. What happened to the queen now that she had made her choice? Surprisingly, that ring is the last surviving record for Ankhes and Amun. After this moment, the queen disappears. No texts, no art reference her again. This is curious. Did Ankhes and Amun die? Or did the new king, Ai, push her into the background? A forced retirement for Egypt's ruling lady. Again, this is an uncertain question. The best we can do is discuss a couple of clues. Ai became the king, and then Ankhes and Amun disappears from the record. The ring, presenting their cartouches side by side, is the only information for Ai and Ankhes and Amun in the same place at the same time. Following that, we must work from scraps. So far, our best trace is a mummy. In 1817, a tomb came to light in the Valley of the Kings. It is a small monument with 18th dynasty architecture. And when they opened it, excavators found two mummies inside. They also found some pottery, ornamental trinkets, and bric-a-brac. It was not a lavish burial, just a couple of bodies in a small out-of-the-way sepulchre. Today, this tomb is called KV21, aka the 21st tomb in the King's Valley. It is unremarkable. No tourists are flocking to this monument. But the mummies found within are curious. You see, the bodies were female, and they were royal. When discovered, the mummies had one arm crossed over their chest. Traditionally, this one arm over the torso seems to be associated with queens or princesses. On that basis, the mummies seemed to be royal women. Unfortunately, the tomb's excavator, a man named Giovanni Belzoni, was rather careless with the find. Instead of documenting it properly and removing the contents to a museum, Belzoni left the mummies in the tomb. Apparently, the lack of treasure or paintings was a disappointment, and Belzoni did not even bother to clear the monument. His notes were brief, and in his book, he only discusses the tomb for a paragraph. So clearly, he was not that interested. The mummies lay in the tomb for a few years, but unfortunately, the Valley of the Kings was not very secure during the early 1800s. A few years after the discovery, someone broke into this tomb. They may have been robbers hoping for treasure, but whatever their goal, these intruders were violent. They smashed the mummies, dragged them up the corridor, and left them to crumble. It was a horrible deed that left the bodies dismembered, with parts scattered throughout the tomb. Yikes. After that vandalism, this tomb disappeared. Rainstorms flooded the area and buried the monument in mud. It lay hidden for over 100 years. Until, in the late 1980s, archaeologists relocated KV21. They uncovered the grave and studied the contents anew. Fast forward to the early 2000s and that famous DNA study of the royal mummies. As part of the larger project, scientists examined the mummies in this tomb. The monument was clearly 18th dynasty by its design and artifacts. So the scientists took a look at the bodies to see what they could learn. That DNA study has been criticized for some of its interpretations and methods. I have discussed all of that previously. For now, let's assume the study was broadly accurate in the basic details. If that is true, then one of these mummies is intriguing. The DNA study suggested that one of these women was related to King Tutankhamun. Specifically, she was related to the fetuses discovered in his tomb. The results suggested, tentatively, that this mummy shared DNA with the two infants who lay in the king's monument. So hypothetically, this might be the mummy of Ankhes and Amun, the queen of Egypt and mother of Tutankhamun's children. Is that conclusion certain? No, not at all. Firstly, we don't know if Ankis and Amun was the mother of those children. The fetuses do not have any texts or labels referring to their parents, so the mother and father are technically unknown. Since they were in the tomb of Tutankhamun, we generally assume he is the father. But when it comes to the mother, that is uncertain. Ankis and Amun could be their mother, but equally, it could be another woman, a wife we don't know about, or simply a lover. The point is, we can't be sure Ankis and Amun is their mother. Therefore, we can't be sure this mummy is her. Secondly, that DNA connection was tentative at best. Scientists argue about the accuracy of this study, and how well DNA even survives after the mummification process and 3,000 years. It's complicated, but long story short, a family connection between these mummies, KV-21, and the fetuses, might be accurate, but how accurate? Are the infants really the daughters of the older mummy, or is the data vague enough to support other conclusions? I won't get into the weeds on this, but there are valid questions around the identity. For example, Professor Mark Gabold has pointed out that the archaeological context of the mummy is noteworthy. The tomb in which the body lay seems to belong to mid-Dynasty 18, around the time of Thutmose IV or Amunhotep III. The architecture and the pottery in the burial seem to come from several decades before Ankis and Amun. In other words, looking at the tomb itself, there is a good chance the bodies come from an earlier date. Again, that's not conclusive. Tombs can be reused. Mummies can be reburied. But Gabold's point is valid. The DNA evidence is slim, and the context of this mummy raises serious doubts. On that basis, it seems the KV-21 mummy probably isn't Ankis and Amun. We still have to talk about it, because it's part of the larger debate and the story of this period. If this mummy is related to King Tutankhamun's children, then at the very least, we have a lady from the royal family. That's noteworthy enough. And finally, the evidence is vague enough to support several conclusions. Even if the mummy doesn't seem to be Ankis and Amun, it still might be. If this body is the queen, then apparently she went into a small burial in the Valley of the Kings. Then, in the early 1800s, that tomb came to light. It was mostly empty, but there were bits and pieces. Unfortunately, after the discovery, someone vandalized the monument, and they all but destroyed the bodies. As a result, two royal ladies buried in the valley suffered in the afterlife. Whoever they were, their story has a sad ending. Queen Ankis and Amun made her choice. Perhaps she was hesitant or resistant to the idea. Or maybe she accepted the necessity. A high courtier, a powerful member of the government, could offer stability and continuity as king. So, Ankis and Amun chose Ai, the god's father, the counselor and advisor extraordinaire. He would be the next pharaoh. As for the queen, her story ends here. After Ai took the throne, Ankis and Amun disappears from history. Did she retire, or did she die? Was she pushed to the sidelines by the new ruler? Or did she meet an untimely end of sorts? These questions still do not have answers. It is possible that Ankis and Amun's mummy survives in a body from KV-21. That seems unlikely, but it might be true. Either way, Ankis and Amun herself now leaves our tale. To say farewell, let's do a quick retrospective. The girl who became Ankis and Amun entered this world around 1357 BCE, give or take. It was year 6 under King Akhenaten and Nefertiti, and the baby received a name appropriate to the Aten-focused court. She was Ankis en Pa Aten, or She Who Lives for the Aten. The princess was third eldest in the royal family. She had two older sisters and several younger siblings. Under normal circumstances, she would probably grow up to serve the court in some fashion, maybe as a priestess for Aten. But fate had other plans. Around the age of 10 or 11, Angesen Pa Aten lost her father. A few years later, her mother also died. And when she was 14 years old, approximately, she ascended to the throne. She became the Ta Hemet Nesut, the king's great wife. Her husband was young Tutankhaten, a child, maybe her brother, her half-brother, or her cousin. We can't be sure on the relationship. What we do know is that these youngsters inherited the titles of their predecessors. They became the ruling couple. A few years into the new reign, the Egyptian government changed its public policy. Moving forward, the sun god Aten would cease to be the sole supreme deity of the court. Once again, the king and queen would honour the traditional deities, in particular Amun, the king of the gods. This return to earlier policies required a statement, and to mark their devotion to the creator, the king and queen changed their names. Now, Ankhesen Pa Aten, she who lives for the Aten, became Ankhesen Amun, she who lives for Amun. Mostly the same name, but a visible shift in royal beliefs. This would be her identity moving forward. As Queen of Egypt, or King's Great Wife, Ankhesen Amun seems like a background figure. Compared to her mother, Nefertiti, and her grandmother, Ti, this young queen is far less prominent. She appears in art, but usually with her husband, Tutankhamun. And unlike her mother and grandmother, Ankhesen Amun did not seem to have her own independent role. This may have been the result of court politics. Perhaps there was a desire to push back against the influence of powerful queens. Or maybe it was a personal decision. Perhaps Ankhesen Amun felt that her role should be more supportive than assertive. We really don't know much about her personality or what she believed. What we do know is that art, public imagery, presents Ankhesen Amun as a secondary figure. She is there for the king, supporting his power with her own. Now to be clear, this had its own symbolism and meaning for the ancients. The main takeaway is that Ankhesen Amun was less visible than her mother, Nefertiti, or her grandmother, Ti. On the surface, it seems like the Queen of Egypt's role, in a general sense, was changing. Compared to her forebears, Ankhesen Amun was more of a background figure. This is a trend that would continue over the coming generations. Now, we reach a terribly uncertain event. About 10 years into their reign, King Tutankhamun died, leaving Ankhesen Amun as the sole royal figure. The couple had no children. They had failed to produce an heir. And as far as we know, there were no other sons or cousins left in the royal family. As a result, the Queen of Egypt had to make a choice. She would need to choose someone to be the new pharaoh. It is possible that around this time, Ankhesen Amun wrote a letter. She may have sent a message to the kingdom of Hatti, the land of the Hittites. According to Hittite annals, Egypt's ruling lady, called the Dakamunzu, or Ta Hemet Nesut, the king's great wife, asked Hatti for a prince. The queen needed a husband, and if they sent a son, that boy would become the king. Historians debate whether this queen was Ankhesen Amun or someone else. There are valid questions and gaps in the material. It is possible these events happened before Tutankhamun and Ankhesen Amun. I have gone with the traditional chronology, but this could change in the future. So we have to be cautious. We can't read too much into events, and we have to stay flexible. If Ankhesen Amun did write to the Hittites, she may have hoped to maintain control over the royal household. A foreign prince would be isolated, lacking political power. Perhaps the queen could rule through him, or overrule him to exercise her own authority. Alternatively, she may have wanted to preserve the bloodline, to bring royalty, regardless of origin, into the court. Again, the queen's motivations are largely unknown. We get hints that she did not want to marry a servant, quote-unquote. But beyond that, her goal is murky. Whatever she intended, the queen's gambit failed. The Hittite prince, Zananza, did not live long. En route to Egypt, or in Egypt itself, the Hittite prince died, and conflict broke out with that kingdom. At home, Ankis and Amun had to deal with the consequences. Her plan, if it was her plan, had failed. Now, there was only one path. She would have to choose a courtier, a member of an influential family, to be the next king. Ankis and Amun chose Ai, an advisor, a counselor, a military commander, and influential courtier. He was in his 50s at least, much older than Ankis and Amun. But politically, he was a good choice. Ai was experienced, influential, and he probably had a son, or at least a nephew. Ai would be a good caretaker, guaranteeing stability and continuity for the crown. There may have been many reasons behind the choice, but these are the most obvious ones today. Following Ai's accession, Ankis and Amun disappears from history. Her fate, unfortunately, remains a mystery. Did she retire, or did she die, by natural or other circumstances? We do not know. But as her tale comes to its end, we can pay our respects to the memory of this Queen of Egypt, a woman who lived in fascinating times and witnessed truly momentous events. Thank you for listening to the History of Egypt podcast. I will see you soon for episode 156, in which we begin the reign of Ai. The new king inherited a precarious situation. How would he deal with Egypt's problems? We'll find out very soon. My special thanks to Stephen, Nidin, Kyla, Evan, Kendra, Jason, Andy and Chelsea, Lience, Mykost, Yola, TJ, Terry, and Linda. These generous folks are my priests on patreon.com, for which I am most grateful. Surely the names of these priests will live forever, and their monuments will surpass all in glory. Thank you so much for your support, and thank you everyone for listening to the show. I hope you've enjoyed this chapter. See you soon!
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.